When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Another day, another BFD for the Biden administration. Yeah, today, kind of a big deal. As the president unfurled his plan to help with the student loan debt crisis. $20,000 up to $20,000 in debt forgiveness if you have a Pell Grant, $10,000 if you don't. Kind of a big deal. A lot of the economists, a lot of the smart people saying this is the right number to target the middle class, the working class. This is going to be helpful. For me, the interesting part, before we get into the nuts and bolts, the interesting part is the response from both sides. Because I said yesterday, nobody's going to be really happy because this isn't, this doesn't meet anyone's perfect scenario. And you know how we are as a people. We want everything perfect and a neat little bag. And our media always is going to say, you know, it's great, but not everyone's happy. And understand, not everyone is ever happy. So this kind of a big deal. What I find interesting, so many people complaining about bailing out students. And this is the interesting part of this, because as I'm listening to these politicians and these pundits and even you know, friends who have something of a problem with it, I couldn't help but, you know, start doing that political word game. You know, let's take out one word and replace it with another. You know, so let's take student out and replace it with CEO in corporations. Because we don't seem to get as upset about bailing out corporate America because, well, we got to do that because it's going to, you know, whatever nonsense they spew. We don't seem to have a problem with bailing out the banks or corporate America or CEOs who make bad decisions or you know, companies that destroy the environment. We don't seem to care much about that. But, oh, boy, we help a student. We help someone next to us. Wow. And I had to listen to Marjorie Trainwreck, Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican representative from Georgia, who, again, is on no committees, has lots of time on her hands to blather on. And she did. She blathered on about how this was the end of humanity and how, you know, this was Joe Biden buying votes. And my first thought is, well, isn't that what politics is about? Doing what the people want you to do? Do what is popular, what the majority of us, isn't that what this is kind of about? Isn't that the point of governing, ensuring that things get done, the things that we, the people, want? Yeah, that's it. That's it, Marjorie. That's reality. Maybe you should think about it. But, you know, she went on and on blathering on about it was going to increase inflation. You know, all of the right-wing blathering points. without bothering to mention the fact that she herself, Marjorie Trainwreck Greene, got a PPP loan of $180,000 that she doesn't have to pay back. And you go, but hold on, Marjorie, wait a second. Let's back this train up. How is it that you get a $180,000 bailout, but someone who just wanted a little skin in the game, helping them is somehow horrible. It's somehow bad. It's going to cause inflation. It could do all these horrible things. How is that? And again, these you listen to these hypocrites go on and on about how it's going to do all these horrible things, and yet, my favorite, you know, Marjorie Greene aside, my favorite, Rick Scott, the senator from Florida, he was doing some mad tweeting on a luxury yacht in Italy. Let's talk tone deaf. Let's talk stupid. Again, major disconnect, folks. Major disconnect in what's going on. And for me, this is a major moment for the working class because this is another win. This is another win for working families. And you go, well, how's that possible? How is this a win for working families? Because we pay all this. We're finally helping people who need it. Understand, the cost of higher education, stop and think about this. From 1971 till now, the cost of higher education is quadrupled when compared to our wages. So there's this massive disconnect. Massive disconnect. And we know that the people who are saddled with these student loans are working people. This is why the right kind of losing their mind. Now, I got to tell you, I'm kind of surprised that it isn't louder. They didn't even get it trending on Twitter, but they did put up their talking points. This is going to cause inflation because, you know, that generation of kids who can't buy a house, those people who can't buy a car, a new car, they got to get that crappy one. You know, that somehow, them being able to do those things, leading something of a life, bad. That's the amazing part here for me. Now, as I said, if you have a Pell Grant, it will be up to $20,000. That they will forgive in debt. If you don't have a Pell Grant, up to $10,000. They did means test it. I know Republicans love that. And look, I'm not against it either. If you are earning less than $125,000 a year, you are then eligible for the forgiveness. Above that, sorry, you're out of luck. Students who student loan pause extended for the final time through the end of the year. So everyone will have their student loans on pause through the end of the year, as we have been doing through the pandemic. That's going to be helpful to some. And the big part, you know, everyone's focused on the $20,000 if you had a Pell Grant and $10,000 if you don't. The big part of this is if you have loans for an undergraduate program, you can cap repayments at 5% of your monthly income. That is pretty massive. Considering I know people who have, you know, I don't know, half of their income going to student loans. This is, again, to steal a Joe Bidenism, pretty big blanking deal. And a massive win, as I said. Now, for some 20 million students, their loans will be zeroed out. Another 23 million will get that $10,000 erased. Again, that is huge. And as I said, you know, you're going to lower the monthly payments, which is going to mean more money into the economy, more. And I know. But Rick, it's going to cause inflation. No, it's going to cause economic activity, and business can then thrive off of that. This is not a bad thing. No matter how much the right wing blathers, and no matter how much they whine and complain, not a bad thing. Now, for those who say, well, I didn't go to college because it was too pricey. Well, you know, there are winners and losers in every program, and I'm one of those. I chose out of high school not to take on enormous debt. I chose to go get a union job and go back to school later in life. That was my choice. And I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem helping people in this moment. So pretty excited about this. Again, another victory by the administration, another step forward. I think a good thing. I really do. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break right here. When we come back, teacher strike going on in Columbus, Ohio. I got to get a couple of minutes to talk to them, find out what's going on, because this could be a big deal too, as there is talk, as I understand, of strike breaking by using cyber charter schools. This is a bad thing. Right back after this. If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible two-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. So let's talk about moving education in the wrong direction. I'm looking at the Springfield News Leader newspaper from Missouri. Evidently, the school board in Missouri there, we're making spanking great again. Yep, they're going to bring back spanking to school because that's going to make kids learn. Oh, boy, will it. Let's talk about every bad idea to make education worse that we see on the right. And then let's talk about the people who are trying to fight and make it better, which is why I'm not happy to see striking teachers out on the picket line. But the reason they're out there fighting the righteous fight, that's a good thing. And here to share some thoughts on what's going on out in Columbus, I've asked Regina Fuentes to come talk with us. She is a spokesperson for the Columbus Education Association, also a high school English teacher there in Columbus. Regina, thanks for taking time for us.
Good evening, and thank you for having me.
So let's talk about why are you guys out on the picket line? What's going on?
Well, we are feeling the pain of teachers across the nation. And, you know, it's about time that, you know, somebody stood up for the students in the United States and said something about these conditions in these buildings. You know, we have been asking our school district for years to address the dilapidated buildings and to do something about it. And we know that they have the funds available. They can do this work, but they just keep passing it off. So we're trying to have them put accountable language in our contract that actually has true timelines, true dates of when they are going to finish this work that they've promised our students so much. And they just keep holding back from actually doing these things. Also class sizes and making sure that we have music, PE, and art in elementary classes that for some reason they cut.
Yeah, it makes no sense to me when you start when you hear these stories of cutting all of these programs in these classes that many people my age took for granted going through school. And when you tell people that this stuff has been just eviscerated in public education because of a number of reasons, charter schools and privatization and all of these schemes that they've come up with and just gutting education funding, as we had done a couple of times here in this state of Pennsylvania, people are kind of shocked. So it takes something kind of shocking, like going out on the picket line, because this isn't something you guys do often. In fact, I was looking it up. The last time there was any, I guess it's the first time since 1975 that your union has gone on strike?
That is correct, 1975. And this isn't a decision that came, you know, lightly. We did everything we possibly could to avoid going to a strike, but the district abruptly walked out on negotiations twice and would not complete the negotiation process. And it just, speaks volumes to, you know, they put out there that kids come first and they care about their teachers, they care about their schools, but their actions are saying that it's not true. And we are just trying to finally get something done and use this opportunity to really, you know, pinpoint and get something done for our students who deserve so much better.
Yeah, you know, we're in a moment, Regina, and this is one of those things where you go, there's so many attacks going on against teachers, and there's so much nonsense being thrown at you guys that I don't know why anyone does it anymore. And good, thank you for doing it. But you know, in this moment, I'm sure that some of the loudest opponents are attacking you guys. What kind of response are you getting from people in your community?
The community actually has been amazing. We have had tremendous support from our parents, from our students. They see the gaslighting happening. I mean, when we tell them these specifically are the things we're asking for, and the district comes back and says, well, we just don't know what they're asking for. I mean, come on, what are you doing? You are not valuing the intelligence of our parents. You are not valuing the people who voted to put you in that position, and you're not valuing what the public wants. You weren't put into that position to do your will. You were put into that position to do the will of the people. And the will of the people wants you to listen to the teachers, listen to your students, and get these schools fixed.
Yeah, you know, I've talked to teachers who have been on strike in the past, and I've never found one who's happy to be there. But they know why they're on strike. They know what they're fighting for. And interestingly enough, it's rarely about their own personal wealth. It's rarely about their own. It's rarely about themselves. It's always, it seems, about making conditions better for the students, you know, while simultaneously making their conditions better. Because after all, you know, your working conditions are your students' learning conditions. So as parents, yeah. I know I want the best conditions for you and for my children. So it's really just bizarre and strange to me that you're in this position.
It is. And, you know, I've been beating that drum, you know, for a while. I just don't understand why it is that public education or education in general is not the most important investment in the nation. I mean, our students don't stay young and students for their entire life. They become the voters of tomorrow. They become the citizens of tomorrow, the workers. You know, why aren't we trying to ingrain in them the very best and treat them with the very best so that our communities thrive, our nation thrives? Yeah. No, it's always the bottom of the list. And, you know, I think that this is just going to be the beginning of a movement of teachers and workers, actually laboring workers who are just tired of, you know, being stepped on and ignored, essentially, when it comes down to our working conditions.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Regina Fuentes. She's the spokesperson for the Columbus Education Association. If you want to check out their website, ceaohio.org is that website. You can take a look at it. You guys are, as I understand, raising some funding. A GoFundMe page out there was looking to raise $5,000. You're up over $60,000 now on that page. And I hope folks will go and donate to help get you through this, because the district is doing something, as I understand, and you can help me if I'm wrong here, but it was reported to me yesterday that the district has cut off your health insurance in one of the most union-busting things possible, which tells me that they really don't want to settle this. They really don't want to have you come to the table. They want this adversarial fight.
Yes, and it makes absolutely no sense. I mean, these are elected officials. They weren't elected to be doing, you know, these things that they are doing. They don't really care about teachers. They don't really care about the students if everything is punitive. And we're just trying to get a contract that is, you know, fair, and it's not unlike any other process we've ever gone through before. And, you know, we want the best for our students, and we know what's best for our students because we're there. We're on the front lines. These district officials, they don't ever come into our classrooms to do what we do. So why even question it? who knows best what's best for our students? We do.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to get. And I think it would be a value to them to hold themselves accountable the way they push our students to hold themselves accountable and the way that they push us to hold ourselves accountable.
Yeah, one of my favorite bumper stickers is, if you can read this, thank a teacher. It's one of my favorite ones. But, you know, here's the thing, and I got to wonder, you yourself, I'm sure this isn't where you want to be today. I'm sure this isn't what you want to be fighting for. And I can't imagine there is anyone who is. But ultimately, you know, and I've said this a number of times over the years, I think teachers are one of the most abused professions in the country. Wage theft in the education industry, if you will, is rampant because you guys are forced to work so many hours that you're not compensated for. And a lot of the times you're digging into your own pockets for supplies that you don't have because you need them. This just seems to be one of those moments where we should be talking about all of this stuff, not just narrow right. things that the district keeps pushing out.
That's right. And I think, you know, the district is trying to dampen that message and put it out. But we have lit the flame. I mean, honestly, this is something that's going to be explosive, I think, across the nation. It's already happening. You know, teachers are burning out. Students are burning out. And, you know, it has nothing to do with the curriculum and what we're doing. And it has everything to do with our conditions and the way that, you know, the leadership and these districts want to micromanage teachers, you know, over plan and try and, you know, we're professionals. We have years of college education, but they treat us as if they have to tell us what to do. And it's just so insulting,
yeah.
you know, to, you know, for teachers to have to be micromanaged.
Well, I've argued they're trying to make it like factory work so that they mm-hmm. don't have to have professionals doing it. And you could do what they're doing in Florida. Just, hey, as long as you're taking a couple of courses, yeah, you can be a teacher. What the heck? That's a problem for me because, you know, I've seen some of their writings and it's scary stuff. The other yes. thing that I saw, and maybe you can help clear up, one of the concerns that I have is there's talk of potential strike breaking, union busting going on yes. by using virtual, going back to the cyber stuff. Is that happening? Is that going to happen? You know, is there any information you can give me on that?
Well, they did virtual learning to open school today, and it was an absolute disaster. you know,
as it has been for the last 2 years. Yeah,
exactly. The reason we went to virtual teaching last year for part, you know, the school year was because we were in a pandemic. It was a health issue. There is no health issue right now. There is no reason why they should be in virtual teaching. If they truly have the professional subs that they say they have, and they have the ability to open school, then they should actually be opening brick and mortar schools and teaching those kids in the classroom. But the truth is that it's just a farce. It's a lie. They don't. There is no substitute for great teachers. And the great teachers that the parents want in the classroom is us.
Yeah.
It's not these individuals that they just, you know.
I'm grateful for all the teachers that my kids have had over the years. Because I know I can't do it. I have a hard enough time with my three keeping them in line. I can't imagine a class of 20, 30. I've even seen in some places 50 kids in a classroom, which is
That's
just
right.
insane. So you know, lastly, leave us with something positive, because I looked at someone like you who hasn't left teaching, and I know this is a labor of love for so many. You know, why do you do it?
Because it's always new, and these kids teach me as much as I feel like I teach them. And, you know, I have so many stories of students who, you know, didn't believe in themselves or didn't think they could get through something. And that light bulb comes on. And every single time I've seen it more than, you know, probably 100 times in my career, and it never gets old. You know, I laugh every day. I sometimes cry with my students. I really, it's all about the relationships. And that's what I really love, is that, you know, it's an opportunity to really reach young people and have an effect on someone's life that, you know, is everlasting. And that's what keeps me in the classroom.
Good on you, Regina. I wish you guys the best. I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date on what's going on. Keep up the fight. One day longer, one day stronger. Regina Fuentes, I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Make sure you check out the website, CEAOhio.org, if you want more information. Also, make sure you check out their GoFundMe page. We'll get links out on social media. You can do that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, I gotta say, today, another BFD, another big freaking day. Another massive win. And then look, you know, as I've said before, Biden wasn't my first choice. Was not my first choice. But for a guy that doesn't say much, getting a lot done. We went through 4 years of guy who did nothing but talk, got nothing done. We've got a guy now who doesn't talk at all, just getting stuff done. And this while I'm sure not everybody happy, it's going to make a lot of people happy, and it's going to help our economy, I think. And here to share some thoughts on today's announcement on the debt forgiveness, I've asked Jesse O'Connell to come talk with us. He's Senior Vice President of Education Policy there at the Center for American Progress. You want to check out their website, AmericanProgress.org. Jesse, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, my pleasure, man. This is a really exciting thing to be talking about.
No, this is huge. So give me the basics. $20,000 for people who took out a Pell Grant, $10,000 if you didn't. Explain that. Why that matters.
Yeah, and I think the other important detail to note is, you know, sort of targeting at this at middle class and working families, right? People making less than $125,000 a year, $250,000 as a couple. And, you know, that relief is still going to reach 95% of student loan borrowers. I think they really sort of did a very savvy job of threading the needle here of getting the relief to people that need it, sort of recognizing that this was a action that kind of is in response to how our system of college has gotten unaffordable. But, you know, those top line forgiveness numbers, Rick, are what have been getting a lot of attention. But this was really a more comprehensive package than that, right? They continued the pause on student loans through the end of the year, recognizing that no one's ready for that system to be turned back on. And even bigger than that, you know, this repayment plan that they announced that's going to limit payments to 5% of income and sort of cut the time to forgiveness to 10 years, that's going to dramatically drop payments for most people. Savings of, you know, over $1,000 a year for many borrowers. So ultimately, we're talking about an action today that is reaching 43 million Americans. 20 million of those 43 are going to see their debts totally wiped down to zero. You know, I think in the lead up to this, when people were trying to anticipate what we'd learn, I think this exceeded that scope. Like this really, really is a big deal.
So let's take on the arguments from the right first, because, you know, you had Marjorie Taylor Greene going on this rambling. It's inflation. It's, you know, it's rewarding, you know, people who made bad decisions, even though she herself took $180,000 in PPP money that she didn't have to pay back. So didn't mind bailing her out, but someone else, well, that's a problem. What do you say to the people who say, look, you know, you're just bailing out people who knew what they were doing, Jesse? They took these loans out. They should have to pay them back because, well, most of the time, unless you've gotten debt forgiveness from the federal government on other things, you're a CEO, your corporation, you have to pay them back. What do you say to that?
So I think it shows that people are looking at our system of higher education through the wrong lens, right? That it's sort of about choice and that this is something that people decided to do and they're going back on a commitment that they made. You know, for basically a generation now, we have leaned on student loans to paper over these tremendous gaps in how we ensure that college is affordable for people. You know, it used to be that on about 6 weeks of minimum wage work, you could pay for a semester of tuition, right? That's sort of why we see a lot of lawmakers and policymakers today reflecting on, oh, I worked my way through college. Why can't students today work their way through college? And the simple answer is we stopped making that public investment in our higher education system. So the Pell Grant, which, you know, sort of a lot of people are hearing about today because of its role in determining eligibility, you know, for the greater amount of loan forgiveness, the Pell Grant used to cover 70% of the cost of college. And today it only covers about 30%. So this notion that students, you know, sort of made a choice that they're going back on, we tell people that you need to pursue education after high school, to get a credential, to participate in the economy, to have the kind of economic opportunity and success that people want to have. And then we sort of hand them the bill and say, you know, we told you to do this. We told you this was the right choice. We told you this is going to pay off. And people listen to us. So I see a lot of this as kind of delivering on the implicit promise that this is the right thing to do and that our economy needs people to be pursuing these credentials that lead to good, fulfilling careers.
So how does this fix the overall problem, which is college is way too unaffordable? The tuition rates have gone through the roof. I mean, even when I went to college back in the 80s, tuition was, you know, it was a lot more affordable than it is now. Now, how do we fix that situation to where you can go back to 6 weeks of minimum wage work, being able to pay for a semester? Does this do that, or is that something that has to be done down the road? Because look, I'm all in favor of debt forgiveness. I'm in favor of, you know, going, you say, okay, let's buy up all those loans and do something with them. But if we're only picking this generation as winners, what about the next group of kids who are going to have to do the same thing? Have we fixed that situation that got us into this situation?
Yeah, Rick, I think it's the right question to be asking. I think what we can say about today's action is that it was an important first step to get there, right? If we think about the forgiveness portion of it itself, I think that is a response to this extraordinary period that we've been through, right? You know, we had graduates who, starting with the Great Recession, have just sort of, you know, made the right choices and continually not been able to get up off the mat as things have happened that have prevented that college degree from having the return that they thought it would. So I think the forgiveness action is sort of recognizing the different ways that these policies have come up short recently. But forward looking, you know, I think buried towards the bottom of this announcement was, you know, sort of this commitment to actually look at the schools that are producing some of the worst outcomes, that are producing some of the highest levels of debt without giving students the kind of education and the experience that they expect, and to sort of name names and actually really get that information out there in a way that hopefully we'll start to see some changes in institutional behavior. And you know, I think beyond that, we didn't see stuff that was, you know, done today through this action, but this administration has put forth a bunch of ideas previously about ways to make community college free, to invest in HBCUs and MSIs, and sort of put our investments in the types of places that we know are lifting people into a different situation from generation to generation, which I think is what we want to see, right? We want to meet our students where they are going today.
Yeah, but you know, there's also this thought, and this keeps coming up, that especially on the right, going, well, not everyone should go to college. Not everyone is college material. They should be doing other things. You know, what do you say to that? Because, look, I wasn't ready for college at 18. I wasn't ready, you know, at 19. In fact, you know, my first year was wasted on me. It wasn't until I got to be a little bit older, a little bit more mature, that I then was able to get something out of it. What do you say to those people who say not everyone should go? There should be other paths, other tracks. But because, look, you know, I know so many people who go, the only path to the middle class is to get this piece of paper, need the golden ticket to get into the middle class, even though it's not the bang for the buck it used to be. What's the response to that?
Yeah, I think the response is that college is a tricky word and it means different things to different people, right? So I think when you hear the criticisms that you just laid out, they're using college to stand in for that kind of traditional conception of a four-year residential experience that, you know, you go away from home, you live in a dorm. But college, really, what we're talking about here is sort of all of the different pathways that you can follow after high school to get credentialed skills. They're going to lead to good jobs, right? 37% of today's students are older than 25. 64% of them work part-time. And the thing that always blows people's mind is if we look at people in higher education today, only 13% of them live in that residential experience, right? So most of these students that we're talking about, they're older, they have responsibilities outside the classroom, and they really are pursuing credentials that, you know, let them work as an early childhood educator or as a home health aide or in, you know, jobs like trucking require skills that are credentialed. All of these things come with costs, and people have taken out student loans for all of these credential pathways. So I think it's easy to fall in the trap of saying that we are talking about, you know, people with high balances that, you know, did kind of these liberal arts degrees, and it's not really the case. We're helping today a lot of people that attempted college and didn't complete and are being held back by their balances, you know, pursued workforce-oriented credentials that didn't cost a lot of money but haven't come in the way that people thought. So I think we need to break out of sort of the word college, meaning what the New York Times wants it to make, and not what actual working class people are looking for to improve their lives and to improve their economic situation.
Yeah, you're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Jesse O'Connell. He's the Senior Vice President of Education Policy there at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. We're talking about today's big freaking deal, President Biden's announcement that they're going to forgive up to $20,000 of debt forgiveness for student loans with people with Pell Grants, up to $10,000 if you didn't have a Pell Grant. But the big one, the big part, capping your repayment at 5% of your salary, which I think is huge. Now, you know, there's some other arguments that I get. You know, what about the left's arguments? I get a lot of people on the left going, well, I didn't get to go to college. What's in it for me? We've become kind of a selfish society, haven't we?
You know, it's tough, Rick. And I view this as, this is what government should be doing, right? Like, government should be stepping in when we expect things of people, but there's market failures. I think there's a huge role to play here in acknowledging that there's lots of people in different public service roles, and we want them in those roles, but they're never going to be the highest paying jobs. And this is a way to support them. You know, I think hidden behind this announcement, because it's been happening on an ongoing basis, this administration has forgiven $35 billion across different existing forgiveness programs. They finally made public service loan forgiveness work. They've forgiven loans for 175,000 public service workers. They finally got around to making the borrower defense to repayment rules work, which says if you're defrauded by your institution, we'll forgive your loans. All of this is having the aggregate effect of this being an administration that is taking seriously the promises of what our higher education system has said all along. And we're really starting to see a lot of that come in.
Yeah, I would like to see the administration, I'd like to see the Department of Education go after some of these predatory colleges, that these fly-by-night places, basically diploma mills online. And that, you know, I've known people that have taken these programs, they spend lots of money and nothing. I mean, the degrees are worthless. The education isn't to the same standards. I think we really have to evaluate where a lot of this money is being spent as well. Do you agree?
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, just last week, the Department of Ed fired an accreditor, right? This accreditor, ACICS, was the accreditor that let ITT operate, it let Corinthian College operate. And finally, we saw action to say that they no longer could be a guardian of all of these billions of dollars of federal student financial aid flowing to these institutions that were essentially enrolling students under, you know, sort of false pretenses and not educating them in the way that they thought they were. So I expect that we'll see more of this. You know, there's been some rulemakings underway to be really rigorous about the outcomes that that these institutions need to provide.
Let's talk about the politics of this. How do you think this is going to play? You've got, again, Marjorie Traitor Greene and a bunch of the Republicans screaming that this is Joe Biden just trying to buy votes. He just wants to buy votes. And I would argue, you know, I can throw my two cents in here, that's what they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be doing what the people want. They're supposed to be doing what's popular. And yeah, if it helps them get votes, that's kind of how the system's supposed to work, isn't it?
You know, I think it's even simpler than that. I think people like seeing government work for people. I think people like seeing government do things, right? And even if you want to quibble on the merits and say, oh, I would have done it slightly differently, or I would have done it this way, what matters is they're making progress. They're taking problems seriously. They're trying to solve them. You know, like I said, we're likely to see 20 million people see their student loan balance go to zero. That is a lot of people who are going to wake up and have in a different emotional state, a different financial state. And those people are in their communities. They're going to talk about, hey, look, government stood up for me. They delivered on something that I had hoped for, that I had expected. And I think in some ways that transcends politics, right? Like, that's ultimately this notion of coming together around a sense of commonwealth to actually do good in people's lives.
Now, yeah, this is a big deal. But what do you say to the person, Jesse, who goes, well, by doing that, by forgiving these 20,000 people's debts, they're now going to go into the economy. They're going to spend that money frivolously and wrongly and going to cause inflation. They're going to make my life worse, which is what the argument that I'm getting most often, that this is going to cause massive inflation and we're going to all suffer because of this.
Well, listen, I'm not an economist, but I'm pretty confident that inflationary lens is not the way to think of this. Student loans have been turned off since the start of the pandemic. So money that would be going to student loan payments has not been going to student loan payments at any point over the past couple of years. So it's not like that is going to change. Ultimately, we're talking about the impact on wealth, right? I think this is going to sort of close gaps that we've seen between different groups in terms of their ability to accumulate wealth. I think this is going to let people start to make plans for the future in terms of saving for retirement, thinking about buying a home. And really, I think in the sort of run of how we measure these things, we're going to see people who are doing better, who are feeling better, who are more engaged in their community. And I think that's the conversation that we need to be having.
Yeah, good stuff. Now, there's no way to undo this, right? This is going to be done. This is kind of a done deal then?
That's probably the trickiest thing to say here. I think what's really apparent is this administration thought about this really hard. They worked on it for a long time. They were really thorough. They looked at all the angles. I think they are as confident as they can be that they are doing this based on, sort of underlying statutory authority. I think predicting the future is a tricky thing, but, I'm pretty confident that this is change that's going to make an immediate impact in people's lives and last.
Good stuff, Jesse. I appreciate the time, the thoughts, the input. Good stuff. Good day, right?
Yeah, big day. Really good day.
Good day. Appreciate it. Jesse O'Connell, Senior Vice President of Education Policy there at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is where you can check out the work that he does there. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the day that the United Farm Workers went out on strike against California lettuce growers. The United Farm Workers had led a successful boycott against grape growers that had drawn national attention to the harsh working conditions and low pay of those who harvested our nation's food. In an effort to keep the United Farm Workers from organizing lettuce workers, some of the growers had signed contracts with the Teamsters Union. The United Farm Workers argued that these contracts did not represent the workers' best interests. As thousands of workers went on strike, Cesar Chavez called for a national boycott of all non-union lettuce. In the lead up to the strike, an estimated 4,000 workers attended a meeting in Salinas, California. One worker, Antonio Segredo, explained the importance of the action. Rael Macaredo, voice of the Farm Worker newsletter, reported his words, quote, "Let the people and the government of the United States know that we are ready to work, but that we must have what we ask. It isn't very much. We don't ask the impossible, only that they look upon us as human beings. We have the same ambitions that they do. We have families. We have rights. Why must they continue to treat us like beasts of burden and look for a thousand ways to bring us down?" That December, Cesar Chavez was jailed for leading the boycott. Putting pressure on the growers through encouraging the public to boycott non-union harvested food was a key tactic for the farm workers' movement. It impacted the bottom line of the growers and moved them to sit down at the bargaining table.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So I love this story, especially when you're looking at the backdrop of the student loan forgiveness. Because, again, Ron Johnson, one of the guys against the administration doing this, he was attempting to justify, defend his wealth doubling during his term in office and his participation in, slipping a little language into Trump's only legislative victory, which was a massive handout to rich people like Ron Johnson, trying to defend that, which I don't know how you do. But he said that, those people out there, those people in the media, those moneyed people, they're playing class envy. And this is one of those things I find very interesting. When the wealth class plays the class war card and then tries to be the victim. Understand, he's in a position to make his wealth double during his tenure. He's in a position to insert things into legislation to make himself and people like him better off. But yet, when the Oshkosh company in Wisconsin said, "No, we're not going to make our vehicles that we got the contract from the federal government here in Wisconsin. We're going to go to non-union South Carolina and we're going to do some good old-fashioned union busting, and we're going to take those jobs down there. He said, well, we've got enough jobs here in Wisconsin. Which, you know, this is one of those weird moments. Because in any other moment in my lifetime, if a politician were to say, yeah, my state's got enough. My state has more than enough jobs, good paying jobs with health care benefits and retirement security and a living wage and safe working. We've got enough of those. That would be a career ender. And I look at the 4 years of the former guy. He had like 100 scandals and incidents where those would be career enders for anybody, any other administration. It would be the end for them. But no. Because they're masters at playing the victim card. They really are. You got to give them credit on a certain level. Poor me, multimillionaire. Poor me, my wealth doubled. And you're just playing class war. It's just class envy. Yeah. When a generation of kids they're saddled with massive student loan debt so that you can be wealthier, there's a problem there. When we're talking about education systems, K through 12, where teachers are being cheated out of wages and their standard of living is worse off, and we don't have, you know, music and art and gym and librarians and nurses. But yet, hey, we doubled the wealth of the wealth class. Our roads, our bridges. You stop and you think of all the things that we could be investing, the kind of money that we've given away in massive tax breaks to the wealthy and corporations, and the sacrifices that the working class has made to make that, to earn that wealth for them, only to have it, well, squandered. I know, the rich people are the smart ones. They know what to do with the money, and you're right, they do. Make themselves more money. It's what they do. And heaven forbid working people say, you know what? We demand better. And I looked at this story in just here in my backyard. In Harrisburg, there's a pizza chain. They have a couple of pizza shops locally where the workers said, hey, we want to unionize. They marched on the boss and said, here's our petition. We have a majority of support. How about we work together? How about we sit down, we work out a contract, we work out some working conditions, we make things better here. Because can you imagine? I mean, we're talking about a small, I think 11 or 12 people work there. Small organization. Can you imagine how bad the conditions must be for those workers to go, you know what? We're demanding that you, the boss, respect us. And in good, in predictable fashion. The Need Pizza folks, KNEAD, Need Pizza folks, announced on social media that they were closing their doors. You're not going to make us have unionized workers. Oh, no. So instead of sitting down and talking with their employees, instead of negotiating in good faith with their employees, they closed the door. And I came out with the reality is what should happen. No one should ever go to a pizza shop opened by these people ever again. And this is one of those things that should be remembered. Because remember, these are the workers who are the frontline heroes. These are the people who showed up to work. These are the people who sacrificed. And yet the owners, well, we're just going to close the door. It's our right to close the door. And it is. It is their right on a certain level to do that. I kind of hope they decide that they're going to open up under a different name in the same location. So legally they get, you know, taken to the cleaners, but that's a whole nother argument for another day. This is the kind of stuff that's going on. The wealth class of this country and the people who run these companies. Now, this is a very small example, but you look what Starbucks is doing. They're closing places too. You look at what Walmart has done. They've closed stores. They've closed entire stores because a handful of auto repair folks unionized, or butchers decided they wanted to unionize. The powered elite are never going to give up control. the moneyed elite are never going to share. Never voluntarily. Nothing is ever given. Sorry, this idea of the benevolent employer, the benevolent wealth class, that doesn't exist. Because when times get tough, they seem to get tough on the people on the bottom. And this is why I've said a million times, every worker should have a union in their workplace. Every worker should sit down and be able to collectively bargain with their employer to ensure the best wages, hours, conditions possible, and the best respect possible. But we have a system currently that is broken. And this is why it's important to have an administration like the Biden administration, who is friendly to working people, who is fighting the fights for working people. Because you stop and think about it. The Rescue Act that helped families get through the pandemic, and all of the investments in communities that went to help communities. You stop and you think about the infrastructure bill that's going to be rebuilding infrastructure and creating jobs. You think about the PACT Act that's going to help veterans. You think about this Inflation Reduction Act that's going to create jobs and help get people with get insurance and lower the cost of prescription drugs. We're talking about, and now this student loan thing, this is really focusing on helping the working class of this country like no other administration in my lifetime. This is one of those moments where the working people of this country should be rallying around this administration. And yet you got half of them who have this blind loyalty to Donald Trump, who did nothing for them. Nothing.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to thericksmithshow.com. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, I'm still amazed that 11 Republicans voted against the PACT Act that is expanding the VA's health care program and benefits for veterans who are exposed to burn pits and other toxic substances. And again, we went through that whole whatever that was of blocking it and filibustering it so that they could, you know, our Republican friends could have their little temper tantrum. And again, it's the veterans who end up suffering because of it. And look, rightly so. Republicans took kind of a beating over it, as they should have. But the other part of this is, why is it taking so long? Why does it take so long to help our veterans and to help the people that we put up on pedestals and call heroes? And here to share some thoughts on just that question, he's written the book called Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. That's why I've asked Steve Early to come talk with us. He is one of the co-authors. Steve, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So, you know, let's start with the PACT Act. You know, I got to tell you, in looking at this, this should have been a no-brainer, should have been 100-0. Every senator should have voted for it, especially considering that they all have pictures of them wrapped themselves in the flag with soldiers all around them for their campaign literature. This should have been 100-0.
Well, when rubber meets the road in the field of Veterans Affairs, we often have members of Congress, including some who served in the military themselves, were not very reliable allies of fellow veterans and veterans whose votes they have pursued. The problem of 3.5 million people being exposed to all kinds of toxics, particularly in the last two decades of post 9/11 warfare in Iraq and Afghanistan, excuse me, has been well known for a long time, as you've noted, and more and more burn pit victims have been displaying symptoms of all kinds of serious illnesses, respiratory problems to cancers. And until recently, the rate of denial of burn pit related disability claims at the Department of Veterans Affairs was running at 80%. So this PACT Act has really created some important legal presumptions which favor veterans who are in these war zones, were exposed recklessly and unnecessarily to burn pits, And hopefully it's going to make it easier for hundreds of thousands of them to qualify for disability benefits and for veterans' healthcare system coverage, which is what more of them need. There's 9 million VA patients now, but a lot of burn pit victims have so far been excluded from coverage. And this legislation will hopefully make it possible for them to get through the doors of their nearest VA medical center as soon as possible.
Yeah, you know, what's amazing and frustrating and all at the same time is that we've done this to soldiers throughout history. I mean, this is not new. This isn't a new moment. It's just now we're paying more attention to it. And look, I grew up in the, you know, as a kid in the 70s, and I watched those guys from Vietnam coming home, being dumped into our housing project with their, you know, with their drug and alcohol problems, with their broken bodies and broken minds, and no help for them. And I've always said, you know, if you're going to send them, if you're going to put them up on a pedestal and call them heroes, you got to treat them as such.
Well, you and I are both Union guys. And whatever you may think about the role of the U.S. military, I think everyone has to take a hard look at the behavior of the Department of Defense historically as an employer, the biggest federal government employer. And part of the problem is certainly abroad, but also at home, it's a federal agency. It's not subject to Occupational Safety and Health Act enforcement. It's not subject to the Environmental Protection Act protection. As a worker, as an employee, you can't form a union. That's a felony. So the long history of people being subjected to non-combat related hazardous occupational health and safety conditions that scar them for life, and make their later careers very difficult. And you had a great show on a dramatic example of that not long ago, on the anniversary of the Port Chicago disaster out here, 30 miles from where I live in California. World War II, black soldiers, sailors, forced to work in a munitions dump, and an entirely preventable mass explosion killed over 300 of them. And then when the remaining survivors tried to protest these working conditions, they were charged and court-martialed as mutineers. So, you know, you take it from there to the Agent Orange scandal of the Vietnam era, Gulf War syndrome, and now the struggle over 20 years for recognition of the problems of burn pit victims. And it's a sad and familiar story.
Yeah, this is one of those moments where I, as someone who is a big supporter of the VA hospitals and the work that they do, say we need to be strengthening those, not destroying them. And we just went through 4 years and an administration that tried to privatize our VA. I'm against that entirely because the VA has institutional knowledge that the private sector doesn't have. And they're able to deal with these kind of things and track them, which is kind of why I think they want it destroyed.
You know, you're sounding like a co-author of our book. That's our message in a nutshell. We're great defenders of the VA, and it's the nation's largest and most effective public health care system. It's 300,000 caregivers are extremely dedicated, mission-driven. A third of them are veterans themselves. So there's this incredible and unique culture of solidarity within VA medical facilities, where both patients and providers have had the shared experience of being in the military. You don't get that at for-profit hospital chains. And sadly, though, the Biden administration has not sufficiently broken with the pro-privatization policies of the four very damaging Trumps. Biden promised not to dismantle or further outsource VA services, but last year, about one third of the $100 billion that the VA gets to provide direct care was diverted to the private healthcare industry. And that outsourcing has to stop. It's weakening our system of veterans healthcare. It's not in the interest of patients or providers. And it's not what the president promised when he was running for office 2 years ago.
We've got a lot of work to do. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Steve Early talking about his book, Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends, and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs. We'll get links out on social media how you can go get this, or you can just go to ourvetsbook.com where you can find and pick up a copy of this. Now, you know, as I understand that the VA is down, I guess, like, what, 50,000 people at this point. Again, the hiring hasn't happened to really bring the Veterans Administration back to full strength, which I think needs to be done and needs to be done immediately. I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, that vacancy headcount, to give the Biden administration credit, has gotten a little bit better. I mean, the Trump administration wanted to totally privatize the agency. And one way to do that was not to hire new staff, don't fill vacancies. And there were 50,000 vacancies by the time Trump left office, and that became an excuse to send more people unnecessarily to outside treatment that was more costly, less effective, but very profitable for the healthcare industrial complex. You know, the Biden administration is now faced with the challenge of investing in the VA, building back better, modernizing some of its facilities, and it's fumbled the ball there too. Just a couple of months ago, it released a really conceived and unpopular plan to close VA clinics and hospitals around the country, including major facilities in Coatesville and Philly, Wilkes-Barre. They were going to downsize Altoona and Erie. And there was a huge grassroots uproar, veterans, vets organizations, VA unions, and that facility closing threat for the time being was stopped. But long term, this administration has to reverse course more than it has done in the 2 years so far.
And that comes down to us. Really, I think it comes down to us reaching out and demanding that they not do that. Now, you know, you brought up, you know, veterans and unions and the veterans that are in unions. And I look at our friends at AFGE. I look at our friends at the postal unions, the building trades, their helmets to hard hats programs. You know, a lot of union members are veterans. They seem to go hand in hand in a lot of places, which is strange to me, because politically, we seem to be all over the map, and in some places, voting for people who are, well, you know, anti-union, but still waving the veteran flag, which is kind of weird to me.
Well, I think that's why unions, which represent about one former service members, need to do a better job of identifying veterans in their membership and developing specialized educational training programs and caucuses and councils, as the AFL-CIO has done with its Union Veterans Council, so that they can network, and that people who have this dual identity of having served in the military and now being a trade unionist can use that to help counter the right-wing influences, which are very strong and dangerous in the veteran community. And my own union, the Communication Workers, started a program 2 years ago called the CWA Veterans for Social Change Program. It partners with a progressive veterans group called Common Defense. It's done a lot of training institutes. It's deployed people in political campaigns and issue-oriented campaigns. It's tried to get veterans organizations behind the struggle for labor law reform. So I think that intersectionality, to use a term, between labor and veterans issues, unions need to pay more attention to their members who served in the military. And that will have a positive political impact if they do the kind of work that AFG, CWA, the postal workers, and a few others have done, their internal networks of veterans.
Yeah, you know, I look at this, and we're in a very strange moment politically, because it seems that, you know, there's been a push to radicalize a lot of veterans groups and move them in a what is almost an anti-union, anti-democratic path. I look at my state of Pennsylvania, where there's a guy running for governor, who a career military person who made his living off the government, but hates the government.
It's a common contradiction. And, you know, there's a chapter in the book called Playing the Veteran Card, where we look at the good, bad, and the ugly of veterans politics. Both major parties have invested a lot in recruiting people from military backgrounds, mainly officers, not former enlisted personnel, but well-connected people with college backgrounds. And they're a mixed bag. And Mastriani, a career officer, 30 years on the federal payroll, hates government, seems to have no program for veterans. But J.D. Vance next door in Ohio, not much better. You know, he wants to privatize Social Security, privatize the VA. Hey, great for someone who's made millions of dollars being a Wall Street guy. That's a program for working class or poor veterans in Ohio or Pennsylvania or any other state. So people really need to look more closely, as you indicated, at the positions of some of these so-called friends of veterans in politics, because there's often a big, big gap between the rhetoric and reality of where they stand.
So the book, Our Veterans, Winners, Losers, Friends and Enemies on the New Terrain of Veterans Affairs, co-written by Steve Early. You can get the book at ourvetsbook.com. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. Last question I got for you, outside of getting the book and educating ourselves on these issues, what should people be doing to help our vets? Because like I said, I grew up at a time when, I saw service members coming back from Vietnam, just being dumped into our community. And look, if we're going to put them on pedestals, call them heroes, give them, photo ops and all that, we should treat them as such.
Well, I mean, we're all bombarded by lots of appeals for contributions to veterans charities. And we have a chapter on that. We look at some of the 25,000 of them. They're all kinds of little and sometimes big nonprofits that do good work, in some cases not such good work, helping veterans. What we often neglect is the fact that two of the biggest employers of veterans provide stable, good union, long-term jobs for the Postal Service and the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA healthcare system. And both of them, as we've discussed, have been under attack, threatened with privatization, really badly damaged during 4 years of the Trump administration. And so we should think of a different way of rallying around veterans and supporting them by getting behind these good public sector employers that hire hundreds of thousands of them. And that's why we should support the Save the Mail campaign, the Save the VA campaign, because we're not just preserving important public services, we're also helping veterans in a way that's a lot more concrete and impactful than sending $5 to a charity.
There you go. Steve, I appreciate the time. Great book. Hope folks will take a look at it. Ourvetsbook.com, the website. We'll get links out on social media. Steve Early, appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me again.
Anytime, our good friend Steve Early. Again, ourvetsbook.com is the website. Make sure you check that out. We'll get links out on social media. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to therickSmithShow.com.
If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our labor history in two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible 2-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to therickSmithShow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. Generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at therickSmithShow.com/history today.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
1-866-416-RICK. 1-866-416-7425. Let's go to the phones. We've got Cal on line one. Cal, how are we doing today?
This is your anti-Kavanaugh man off the inferior court. I mean, the Supreme Court. Just two quick points, Rick. When I started in the Chicago public schools years ago, escaping from the suburbs, right away we had one of Cesar Chavez's men talking to a bunch of us somehow. Or Spanish teachers like me, and we all contributed a lot of money that drinking Friday night.
Yeah, wow, that's a good story.
Yeah. Also, on the Florida public schools, you need somebody 87 years old like me who remembers back when, did you know that the Florida schools had been blackballed back in the 60s?
I did not know that. Why?
There were organizations, mainly teachers' organizations, were announcing in bulletins that they put out, like our Chicago Public Teachers, telling people, don't answer their call for teachers, even if it would be your first year teaching. It's a worthless place.
Wow, I'm going to have to look into that. I appreciate it. I appreciate the information. Thank you, Cal.
You're welcome. Bye.
Thanks so much. Let's go to Alice on line three. Alice, how are we doing today?
We're doing good. I just wanted to say I'm glad that we got this student loan forgiveness passed. And hopefully, now that people are deciding, I guess, Democrats, of course, I'm speaking of, meaning Sinema and Manchin, are deciding to play nice, we may get some more things done. And you know, we all forget Biden's, he's not even been in there, 2 years yet?
Yep.
So I say keep up the good work. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Allison. No, that's the message. This administration has gotten some really huge things done. It's really is quite remarkable for all of the shots that he's taken and the approval rating that is ticking up, but still really way too low for the major accomplishments that this administration has pulled off. And the things that are going to help the working class. This for me is the focus. And you go, but it's not perfect. Of course it's not perfect. Nothing ever is. I didn't get everything I want. Well, you never do. That's why you keep fighting and you keep working for, that's why you wake up tomorrow. This isn't that hard to figure out. But like I said, there are some big, big freaking deals here. And they keep coming one after another. And here's where my fear is, just so you know. My fear is that conservative media has done such a good job of souring the American people on Joe Biden that we end up going as a nation going, you know, he just hasn't done enough, even though he's done more legislatively and more to help the working class than any president in my lifetime. I fear that they've conned us into believing, into buying that, well, nothing's getting done. I'm not better off than I was 2 years ago. Nonsense. And then people go to the polls and they vote for Republicans to come in and destroy things and make things worse and get nothing done. And we have 2 years of nothing getting done. And then, well, he hasn't done anything. And then we end up with a Republican president who then reaps all the benefits of all the investments that have happened during these first 2 years. That's what's coming if we don't get our heads out of the sand, or, you know, the other orifice. This is one of those moments. I'll tell you, I was a little harsh on the administration, which I can be, but I'll tell you, they have been getting stuff done, and it's like a wave. It's like, you know, one thing after another, and you know, I think Jesse said it earlier, in the last hour. They really worked on this. They really spent a lot of time, which is why it took so long. There were a lot of people going, well, you've got to do something now, and I'm going, especially on the student debt thing, I'm still not 100% sure where we go. Now, I get you're going to help a generation of people get out from under the huge rock that they're carrying up the hill. I get that. You have to do that. But what do we do to make sure that we fix the problem so the next generation of kids and the next generation of workers who lose jobs and need retraining, they don't get saddled with the same kind of situation and then hope and pray that someone down the road does something to help them. We need to fix the problem now. Because education is our way forward. And look, we should be banning a lot of these for-profit universities, these fly-by-night places that just spring up in some shopping mall. They should go. Or just not get any loan money or any federal money. You think about the massive amount of money. We were just talking about Veterans Affairs, the massive amounts of GI Bill money that goes to a lot of these fly-by-night operations that just hand out paper like it's going out of style. We've got to start really evaluating the kinds of education that we're funding. And I've said from the beginning, it's time to say 12, K through 12 is no longer enough. We need to go K through 14. You need to get that associate's degree, that next 2 years of either your core curriculum courses for college or a vocational program that's going to get you the certificate or the truck driving license or the LPN license to go get a job in the real world and support yourself without being in massive debt. That's what we need to be talking about as well. Nobody really doing that. I think it should be mandatory. Everybody gets those extra 2 years. Just my thought. Love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any of the program? Podcast. Right back after this.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to thericksmithshow.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I got to tell you, there are things about political season that I don't like. And there are some things I really do like. I like fun stuff. I like when people get creative around campaigns to bring people in, to excite people, to grab their imagination a little bit. And my next guest did just that this week for me. Ask me a simple question via Twitter. Hey, people want to know, are you on team cut or team keep? Our candidate here has really long hair, and I thought this was fun. I thought this would be a good opportunity to bring somebody on, talk about the campaign, talk about why cutting, and then to announce my decision on which team I'm going to be on. That's why I've asked Dan Almaney to come talk with us. He is the Democratic candidate for Pennsylvania's State House seat in the 92nd District. Dan, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's funny because you were one of my media gets that I wanted to be a part of in this election season. So it was kind of funny that it was probably my hair that got us here, but that's fine.
No, it was one of those things. You reached out directly to me, and I normally reach back to folks. But this is one of those cool kind of campaigns that I like. I think this is engaging people on a certain level. What kind of responses have you gotten outside of my jumping into this? What kind of responses have you gotten?
It's been a lot of fun. We've had a wide array of comments. My immediate family is super happy that Team Cut is currently ahead. Because they're really anxious for me to get it chopped. But, there are some that are really excited to, shake up Harrisburg a little bit and bring a little more diversity and different hairstyles, at least, to the Capitol. And, we'll see what normal other people can do.
Yeah, I love the video, and I hope folks will take a look at it. We'll get links out on how you can choose between hashtag cut it Dan or hashtag keep it Dan. And you can weigh in, and you weigh in simply by going to one of the links that we're going to put out to get to make a donation. And I will be making a donation at the end of the interview to announce my decision on where I want to go, where I'd like to see Dan go. But let's talk about the campaign. While this is fun and that's great, and it's something to get people's attention, ultimately, we want somebody in Harrisburg, someone in the halls of power, that's going to stand up for working people. That's someone who's going to fight for folks. So, what's that issue that got Dan Almaney involved? What brought you to this?
Well, it was really tough. I saw a lot of what our representative was doing earlier this year, and it got to the point where I couldn't look my daughter in the eyes at bedtime anymore without trying to do something. you know, and since then that decision has become even more important because they're trying to, you know, my opponent is one of the key people pushing for these constitutional amendments to ban abortion, and they want to take her rights away from her. You know, and I know she's only a teenager, but, you know, we see where the consequences are playing out across the country with that. And, you know, again, I'm coming from a working class background. I said my parents were essential workers before they were labeled such a thing. You know, my wife is a nurse and my sister's a Head Start teacher. So we were very, you know, service oriented people, a service oriented family. And this is just kind of my way of wading into those waters.
No, and we need more people who are going to step forward, stand up and speak out and fight back. And I give you credit for it. And I hope folks will check out your website, danforpa92.com. We'll get links out on how maybe you can join the campaign, maybe kick in a couple of bucks. And also you can chime in on the cut it or keep it decision today by making a donation and casting your vote. So, what, you know, that's what got you into this. You know, again, this abortion issue has grabbed a lot of people. And to be honest, it was never something that was all that important to me until now it's gone. And I've got two daughters as well that, you know, I'm worried about their future. I'm worried about them having the right to self-determination, because I know contraception is going to be something that we're going to have to fight to keep as well. And again, their ability to lead the life that they want is in jeopardy. But what's that one issue that gets Dan excited? I mean, is there something? I'm a labor guy. I'm going to fight for workers to join and form unions and fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. You know, what is it for Dan?
Yeah, well, again, as a father, you know, it's kind of education for me. And I really liked your K through 14 idea there that you proposed right before the break. I think that's a really interesting thing that might be worth exploring. But, and I'm proud to have, you know, the support of some of the teachers unions. We haven't announced this anywhere yet, but I can do it tonight, that we are a PSEA recommended campaign. And that's something I'm really proud of. And just, you know, I really feel like the teachers, and I know it's been an education night for you, but it's just, they're so important. And an educated population is a powerful population. And that's really the key. I mean, we've seen in districts right below, right to our south here in the 92nd, Central York passed and fought a book ban with their school board just last year. And we know that those fights are happening in other places in the state, and that's just unacceptable. You know, if you're afraid of a book and afraid of somebody getting smarter, like, that's not the right way to go.
Yeah, I mean, this is why we need people like you who are going to step up. So as you're out and knocking on doors and talking to people, are you getting a sense that that people are concerned, as I am, about the state of our democratic processes, the state of, well, we've got a guy running for governor who I say is basically a Nazi, saying that, you know, if there's an election he doesn't agree with, they may set aside the results. Do you get people who are feeling that kind of fear and that kind of concern?
Yeah, we have I've talked to a lot of people over the last 2 months, and we got into this game a little bit late, which is, you know, one of the reasons we're trying to do some fun with the hair and everything like that. But people are worried about a lot of stuff. They're worried about the overreach of the legislature with the abortion stuff. They're worried about the election. I mean, our representative was on the state capitals on January 5th on our state capitol in Harrisburg, claiming that the election was stolen and illegitimate. And at this point in time, I don't know how you can believe that. And why are you even running for office? Like, that's my question. It's like, how are these people even on the ballot?
That is an interesting question, because I look at some of these folks, they don't have an agenda. They don't have a governing agenda. And it's always been curious to me that people will vote for someone who tells you that they don't believe in government. They don't believe that government can or should do anything. And then people still vote for them. It's kind of insane to me. that this is what where we are, and it's only getting worse. I mean, we're seeing this massive divide between the political parties, polar opposites, where almost nothing gets done, Dan.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I've somewhat jokingly said, you know, it used to be the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats were, are we going to tax businesses at 25% or 35%? You know, now we can't even hold an election without somebody crying foul. And it's just not, it's not the way it's supposed to work. You know, I just want, you know, I'm a simple guy. I'm just, you know, I was born here in Northern York County. I'm a simple guy. I just want good schools. I want a safe community. I want, you know, jobs that can put food on the table and, you know, be able to go on vacation. Like, it's not, you know, I'm not asking for the world. You know, I just want, I want everybody to have a good life, and I want everybody to feel like people are there to help them and to take care of them. And, you know, that's sort of my campaign is sort of centered on those four tentpoles. It's the economy, education, empathy, which is really, I think, one of the key factors, and then equality as well. And you know, you can throw the environment in there as the 50, because we all know that we have climate change and all that stuff to deal with as well.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Dan Almaney. He is the Democratic candidate for the State House here in Pennsylvania's 92nd State House District. Check out the website, danforpa92.com. We'll get links out on social media how you can help out, maybe volunteer, make some phone calls, knock some doors, do some stuff like that, because I'm sure you could use the volunteers. Also, maybe kick in a couple of bucks to help contribute to the campaign. You said empathy, and it seems to be something lacking in today's society, because I look at today's announcement by the Biden administration that we're going to help a generation of students get out from massive student loan debt. And half of our political system is screaming and losing their mind that, you know, we're bailing them out. We're, you know, we're going to cause inflation. This is the wrong message. It's irresponsible. And yet you never hear them say that about corporate America. You never see that when they're talking about a CEO or a bank that's gotten into trouble. But when we're talking about helping the working class, the sky's falling.
Yeah, and that's one of the great mysteries of this 21st century we live in is how we've bought and sold that dichotomy, that somehow the rich people are hardworking and the poor people are lazy, which is, in fact, is quite the opposite in my experience, because, you know, the single mom who's working four jobs to put food on the table for her kids and trying to get them a good education, you're going to tell me that she's not a hard worker, that she's lazy, when you have, you know, Dr. Oz here running around the state pretending he's from Pennsylvania with 10 houses and, you know, taking the time to shop at supermarkets that don't exist? I mean, come on, like it's unbelievable. And, you know, that's, you know, I grew up with that work ethic, because things weren't always great, but we always ate. And I know my dad worked hard. My mom and my dad both worked hard, and, you know, my mom's still working and helping out part time, and, you know, just to stay busy when she should be retired.
Yeah. Now, you said earlier you got the endorsement of a number of labor unions, the Pennsylvania State Education Association. I know you've got the PAFL-CIO's endorsement and others. But I got to ask the question, you know, if, you know, there are people on the ballot, you know, running against you, there are people up and down the Republican side of the ticket who would not only propose and vote for a right to work bill, but would probably make the people in Kentucky's head spin at how fast they would do it here in the state. I'm curious what your position is on the so-called right-to-work bills.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, we need to preserve unions as much as possible. And you know, you mentioned the need pizza folks. I mean, that's just unbelievable that they would do a 180 like that. You know, it's almost unconscionable. And I saw things popping up on Twitter already speculating that they might try to open under a new name or something like that, you know, which seems almost inevitable.
I hope they do.
Yeah. We need to do, and that goes back to the empathy thing. We just need to do a better job of taking care of each other, because at the end of the day, we're all Americans, which for some reason is something that we lose sight of. Red versus blue, but it's red, white, and blue. We're all in this together. And if we really want to try to lift, rising tide lifts many boats. So that's what we need to try to do is, I think when people do better and the middle class do better, you'd be surprised how much better the rich people would have it.
Yeah. No, we all do better when we all do better. It's that simple. Last bit I want to get to before the decision. Sure. Make the elevator pitch. Why Dan Alamany running in the 92nd State House District? Why vote for you?
It might be a cliche, but I'm not a politician. I'm just a dad. I'm trying to make the world a little bit better for my kid and for your kids and your family. I never had dreams of being a politician. I still can't believe, to a certain extent that I'm in this race, but my goal truly is to help, help things move better and be a more representative person than the current one we have.
There you go. Good stuff. The website, danforpa92.com. Make sure you check that out. Also, decide, cut it or keep it. I've decided. I decided immediately. You got to cut it, man. My wife's a big long hair person. Got to cut it, man. In fact, that's where my vote is. I'm on team cut it, Dan. And I will make a donation. I hope other people will go over to Act Blue and do just that. Make your decision and a donation to help with the campaign. Fun in getting to decide that. I guess the question that I now have, since I've made that choice, are you going to run the cutting the beard too?
Well, see, you can't blow all of your. It's a long way. We got 75 days until Election Day, so you don't want to throw all your chips in on the table.
There you go.
Right off the bat, we'll see how it goes, and we'll see how we do here. And then as we push through, I had somebody say, "I'm waiting till you shave it," So
you don't have to shave it.
I know. We're gonna start with the cut, and we're gonna see how it goes, and then from there, who knows what'll happen.
There you go. And if someone makes a big enough donation, as I understand, they actually get to cut it.
Yeah, we're gonna give if Team Cut wins. So this is you, Rick. If your donation is the highest single donation to Team Cut, we'll work it out so that you can come and make the cut under professional supervision.
There you go. Well, I hope folks will check it out. I hope folks will donate. They vote, and I hope you get a good haul in this to help with this election and help you get elected, because we need folks like you in the halls of power. Dan Alamany, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great stuff. Dan for PA92.com. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Rick. Really appreciate it.
Good stuff. Make sure you check out the website, danforpa92.com. Quick break, right back after this with your thoughts. 1-866-416-RICK, 1-866-416-7425. Are you on cut or keep? Love to hear your thoughts. Back after this.
Listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to therickSmithShow.com.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. The year was 1877. That summer, during what came to be known as the Great Upheaval, police, the U.S. Army, and the National Guard brutally crushed a national railroad strike. The simmering anger of working people had many elected officials and industrialists on edge. One man saw the labor unrest as a business opportunity. And on this day in labor history, the treasurer of the Gatlin Gun Company wrote a letter to the president of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad with a proposal. He wrote, "We have the honor to suggest that you strengthen yourself now against such emergencies in the future by providing yourselves with Gatling guns. 4 or 5 men only are required to operate it, and one Gatling with a full supply of ammunition can clear a street or track and keep it clear. The 6-barrel hand-cranked weapon could fire 200 bullets a minute. Upgrades to the gun soon had it cranking out an astonishing 600 bullets a minute. This ferocious new weapon set its sights on the cause of labor. In 1878, in Cleveland, Ohio, 25 prominent citizens formed the Cleveland Gatling Gun Battery to deal with labor uprisings. Armed with 2 of the new guns, the militia drilled and held social events, but never fired the gun against workers. Militias from San Francisco to Connecticut, from Kansas to Pennsylvania, likewise armed themselves. Perhaps the place where the gun became most infamously used against labor was in the Colorado Mining Wars. In 1914, a Gatling-type gun mounted on an armored car was used to shoot up a workers' tent city in Ludlow.
Miss Pavlichenko, well known to fame, Russia's your country.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
All time to come, 300 Nazis fell by your gun.
Rick, 1-866-416-7425. You got a thought, question, comment, want to chime in? I'm loving this story coming out of Florida. Yesterday, the big primary down in Florida, where we ended up with, on the Democratic side, you're going to have Val Demings running against Marco Rubio and Charlie Crist running against DeSantis. I don't know that Crist got much of a chance, but Val Demings, you know, chance to pick up another Senate seat. I think that could be very good. But in the 11th congressional district in Florida, you had this Islamophobic. I'm not going to go there. You had a young woman who right wing lunatic. Wasn't going to go there, but yeah, right wing lunatic, Islamophobe. This Laura Loomer, who lost by about 7%, I guess was the final result. Basically lost her mind, refused to concede. Very Trumpian way, refused to concede. In fact, you know, screamed that her life was over, and that, you know, blamed her loss on big tech's interference, and, you know, because it's always something else. It's not that she's a crummy candidate with horrible ideas. No, it's, you know, she was cheated. She said, "I'm not conceding because I'm a winner." And the reality is our Republican Party is broken to its core, she said. What we have done tonight has really honestly shocked the nation. No, not so much. What shocked the nation is how bad of a sore losers you have on the Republican side, that they can't even graciously say, okay, we both ran, you know, tough campaigns, and, you know, the other side came out. This is how it used to be done. I know it's hard to remember. It's been so long since we've seen people act reasonably, that, you know, hey, we fought a good campaign. You know, we came up a little bit short. We're going to try next time. No. She goes on to say, what we have done here tonight really honestly shocked the nation. We have further exposed the corruption within our own feckless, cowardly Republican Party. Yeah, because that's how you're going to win another election. Call the party that you're part of feckless and losers and corrupt. That's going to be helpful, really going to be helpful in getting you elected. She said, we are losing our country to big tech election interference, and I am pleading with the Republican Party to please start taking this issue seriously. Well, I don't know if, did you miss the MyPillow guy summit? I'm sure, Laura, you missed that, because they had, you know, like 20,000 people watching it. You know, I'm sure they were all, I got to tell you, I watched the summit, and I'm actually sure that more than half of the people who watched it were like me, watching for the entertainment value of just to see how crazy they could get, how far off the deep end, and how many Laura Loomer moments of people just breaking down in weird kind of screaming. Or the best one were the women, the two women who were doing their praise prayer, basically saying that, you know, God worships them, which was just babble. And it made me think, does God ever get tired of these people rambling on about nonsense just to look like they're... It's really very, very, very frightening. But she says she's pleading with the Republican Party to please start taking this issue seriously because the American people deserve representation. And they deserve to have their votes, you know, set aside by, you know, by Republicans who want to go back to the way things used to be. You know, we don't need to vote for anything. We don't need to vote for presidents. We should just have the legislature do it. You know, original intent. And I'll tell you, I came across, while I was at Netroots Nation, I came across a group that's doing some pretty incredible work in you know, saying, look, we want the popular vote to matter. And that they are pushing for states to sign on to no longer saying that, you know, whoever won the state gets the electoral votes, but that they will go with whoever wins the popular vote. And it's kind of an interesting thought that, you know, we could get to a popular vote scenario because it's kind of weird that we had a guy win as president and lose by 3.5 million votes. It's kind of weird. It's kind of like saying, you know, hey, you know, we won the football game, but, you know, we didn't actually win. They scored more points than we did, but we won. It's kind of bizarre. But again, I look at the Laura Loomers of the world and makes me wonder if the participation trophy thing that I've always been against, if that's not part of it. So there is that. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Anything today got under your skin, on your nerves, made you think, made you angry, happy, sad, whatever. I want to hear about it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, make sure you download the podcast wherever you get yours. You can find ours from Podbean to Stitcher, iTunes, all over the place. We are there. Appreciate you tuning in. Appreciate you being here. Look forward to seeing you back here next time. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
What if I told you that you can support your blood pressure and healthy CoQ10 levels with 2 chews a day? The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. That's like getting CoQ10 for free. Our powerful blend of beetroot, grapeseed extract, and CoQ10 supports your cardiovascular health. Visit RadioBeats.com and find out how you can get a free 30-day supply on bundles and save 15% with the promo code DEAL.